It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 103 for Friday the 30th of November 2012. This week we're going to explain a mystery that has stumped conspiracy buffs and science enthusiasts for almost two decades. Plus we'll find out how and why Saudi Arabia has launched a wife tracking service for the mobile phones of men in the Arab state. And we'll uncover why philosophers and physicists have set up a centre to investigate whether developments in human technology may pose new, extinction-level risks to the human species. All that and more coming up. Ahoy, hoy! Nate Langston here. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me, Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
And this week, Ian Steadman.
Hello.
And our rotating panel of talent. It is Ian this week.
It's a privilege to be here.
It's a privilege to have you here. It will be a privilege for anyone listening to this to actually come and join us. We've done two live podcasts over the last 6 weeks or so, but we're about to do a third. Tomorrow, the 30th of November, when we're recording this, we are opening a pop-up store for Wired that will be in existence on Regent Street until the 5th of December. It's going to be in the Quadrant Arcade on Regent Street, which is in London, for those of you who are not aware of where Regent Street is. And on the Wednesday the 5th at 1 p.m. in this store, we're going to be recording episode 104 live, and we're going to have some amazing prizes. All I'm going to say is that if you like consumer electronics that cost quite a lot of money, you'll probably want to come down and try and win one. It's going to be a really interesting show. An hour. It's in your lunch break, perhaps, if you work in London. And Liv, I mean, what's the best adjective you've got for what is going to happen at this event?
Megatastic.
There you go. That's what we do on the show. We make up words. So do come down and we'll repeat this at the end of the show. And go to wired.co.uk/store if you want to know more information about the store itself and other events taking place. But for now, let's get on with some news. And the first one on our list of news today is, it's about something called the Bloop. Now, in 1997, the Bloop was heard on hydrophones across the Pacific, and it was a loud, ultra-low-frequency sound that was heard at listening stations underwater over 5,000 kilometres apart and was one of many mysterious noises picked up by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. Several articles in the years that followed this sound being discovered popularized a hunch of marine geophysicist Christopher Fox that the Bloop might actually have been the sound of an unknown animal. And this was a theory that elevated the Bloop to the level of a great unsolved mystery of sorts. However, the NOAA is pretty sure that it wasn't an animal, but the sound of a relatively common event, which was the cracking of an ice shelf as it breaks up from Antarctica. And several people have linked to the NOAA's website over the past week, excitedly claiming that the mystery of the Bloop had been solved. But we went a little bit deeper this week, and we spoke to NOAA and Oregon State University seismologist Robert Dziak to solve the mystery once and for all. And he confirmed to us, ladies and gentlemen, Liv and Ian, that the Bloop really was just an ice quake. And it turns out that that's kind of what he always thought it was. The theory, I think, of a giant animal making noises loud enough to be heard across the Pacific, was a bit more fantasy than science. It's kind of a slightly anticlimactic end to an otherwise interesting mystery.
It is a shame.
If it's such a common event, an ice quake, how come that wasn't kind of postulated as a potential?
Because they'd only just started listening at the time.
They've
only, over the past 5 to 6 years, actually done comprehensive studies of underwater noises.
I see.
And all these mysterious noises that they picked up, they've kind of gone, oh, it's just ice.
Yeah.
Or it's a boat hitting another boat or something.
Yeah.
There are a lot of noises similar to this, though. There's a Wikipedia page called something like Unexplained Sounds, I think, or Unexplained Noises, that includes the Bloop. And it's this great, I mean, if you're interested in this sort of stuff, go and have a listen to it. Because there's loads of sounds like this that are picked up from underwater. And they, some of them are very, very creepy indeed, but probably do have similarly anticlimactic
explanations.
Yeah. Anyway, let's move out of the seas and over to Saudi Arabia, Liv, where a wife tracking system has been launched.
What's happened is the Ministry of Interior over there has supposedly launched an electronic tracking system that alerts male guardians of women, something that women have to have, whenever the women under their protection are crossing the country's borders for any reason, and they get an SMS when this happens. Mm-hmm. Now, the kind of old system used to be a woman, every time she wants to leave the country, has to have the permission of her guardian, and normally used to have a piece of paper saying that she had the explicit permission of the guardian to cross the border. But I imagine that's probably slightly vulnerable to forgery, that system. So now what's happened is supposedly you now get an SMS. Well, the male guardian gets an SMS when a woman crosses the border. Now, this was discovered when women's rights campaigner Manal Al-Sharif, who actually spoke at Wired 2012, was contacted by a couple on Twitter. And the wife in this couple said that her husband, when she was travelling with her husband, she saw her spouse's phone was going off every time they tried to cross the border because she was listed as a dependent on his national ID card. And initially, the Ministry of the Interior denied these allegations. But since then, there have been loads of other people verifying the allegations, saying that they too have been getting these texts, or their husbands have been getting these texts.
And the ministry's denied it, haven't they?
Well, they've denied it, but then the kind of allegations keep on coming. So it's strange, because the system does appear to be in place and has been in place since about 2010, I think. But it used to be either opt-in or kind of random in some way.
I guess they have to have the phone number.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. You'd have to have the phone number. But it appears that there's lots of people coming out and saying, no, this is actually happening. So it's still a little bit unclear as to whether it's, you know, everyone or just a kind of sample of people, or whether there's some kind of database error that means that everyone's now getting these SMSs sent.
And Al-Sharif spoke to us actually for this story and said, quote, "The irony is that we're using 21st century technology to serve our dark age ideas."
Yeah.
Which you can't really put it more succinctly than that, really. It's absolutely correct. But I mean, there are some incredible restrictions over there on women. I mean, it's still true, I think, that women aren't allowed to drive.
Yes.
Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And they're not really allowed to go anywhere on their own without some kind of, they've got a word for it, I can't remember what the actual term is, but a kind of a male who wouldn't be kind of
chaperone.
Sexually interested in them. Yeah, it's a chaperone, but there's a word that they use in Saudi that describes it very well, but it tends to be a brother or a father has to kind of take them out if you're going shopping and stuff like that.
Mm. Well, to read a bit more about the story, if you do search for Saudi Arabia SMS, you will find a story on wired.co.uk that's got a lot more background and detail on this system. Ian, let's talk about mind-controlled bone-mounted robotic arms.
Yes.
Just to go from one extreme to another. This is something that we've been covering in a bit of depth, actually, this week.
Yes. These are robotic arms, thought-controlled, sort of grafted directly onto the nerves and bones of amputees, developed by a researcher in biomedicine and artificial intelligence at the Chalmers University of Technology in Sweden, by a guy called Max Ortiz Catalan. And it's quite interesting, because normally prosthetic limbs, they work by you kind of attach them to the arm or leg or whatever, and they have these electrodes which are connected onto the skin, and they pick up nerve signals through the skin. And that's not a particularly sort of elegant way of doing it. A lot of things go wrong there. It doesn't allow very precise movements. These prosthetics are attached to the bone using titanium screws, because titanium actually fuses with human bone. And Catalan's dad was apparently the guy who discovered that. And the electrodes are connected directly onto the nerves. So when someone thinks in their mind, oh, I want to, you know, flex my arm out, or I want to clench my fist, it will actually do it much more directly and much more accurately.
Mm.
The first surgeries are scheduled to happen in February 2013.
And I think that's the real news here, isn't it? That this is less than a year away.
Oh, yeah. It's
to be actually bone-mounted. Yeah.
2 and a bit months.
I know we did a whole package of features on transhumanism and bionics and exoskeletons, or exoskeleti, as I think it should be referred to as continually, about this. And there have been works in the past where, say, a prosthetic arm or hand could be controlled by the mind when the system was reading muscles in the chest that would connect to nerves, and then the basically the chest muscles were giving instructions to the arm. But these weren't actually grafted as such. This was kind of, I think, just attached or worn.
And it required some kind of retraining of the to how to use the arm using this kind of system, I think.
Well, this requires retraining as well, but not as much.
Okay.
And it's kind of a two-way learning process because the arm has algorithms and stuff built into its onboard computer. So before the surgery, the amputees have to have training in how to sort of use the arm and teach the algorithm, and the algorithm learns from
them.
The people as well. So it kind of goes two ways. And that's part of another part of the advantage of this, which is that because it's directly grafted onto the nerves, it can send back signals.
That's amazing.
Which is more like, at the moment, if you have a fake arm, like, you know, if something hits it, you don't really feel it.
Yeah.
But this has direct sensory feedback, which is much more important.
This was actually a question that came up at an event I was at this weekend. There was an event on called Hyper Japan, and there was a company there exhibiting something called the Hand Droid, which, if you hadn't realized already, comprises the word hand and droid. This is a company called ITK, and they have been working on developing this robotic hand that had five independently flexible and controllable fingers that they've been working on for about 4 years. But this year they'd linked it up to the Xbox Kinect sensor that sort of has got 3D cameras and things and depth sensors. So you could put your hand in front of it with absolutely no glove or electrode or anything on it, and put a finger up and down or close your hand or whatever, or move your hand, and the robot hand would interpret those movements reasonably accurately without any kind of any kind of strapping to the hand.
So you could do a very accurate hand dance.
Yes, I mean, it's a work in progress. The model they had there was a prototype, but it's really interesting that they're talking about not deploying this in the realms of like prosthetics, but attaching it to the front of things like rovers, so that if there are kind of, say, engineering disasters, or buildings on fire, or there's acid on the floor or something, an environment where humans wouldn't be able to go in, you could send in a robot with these hands on the front, and you could stand in front of theoretically a Kinect and control the hands in 3D.
The US Army does have a bomb disposal bot which they control using Kinect.
Oh, really? Do they have one already?
I can't remember my details, but they definitely have one.
I love the picture of this kind of emergency response robot kind of crawling into a burning building, and it's got these two kind of jazz hands at the front of it.
Well, the thing is, I know that the Kinect aspect of this particular hand isn't necessarily what they're saying is the most innovative. This is just a less disruptive way or a less invasive way of controlling it.
Yeah.
The idea is that this hand is actually incredibly lightweight. It's very, very small and light. It was pretty impressive. We've got a video of it working on the site. If you search for hand droid, again, on wide.co.uk, you will find that video captured.
What's that a portmanteau of again, Nate?
It's a portmanteau of hand and droid, Liv.
Oh, thanks for that.
Yeah,
thank you.
No problem at all. Okay, so next, I want to talk, actually going back to you a bit, Ian. Sorry, I've kind of made this Ian heavy.
Oh, it's all right.
It's heavy with Ian. We're bursting with Ian today.
I'm actually quite sensitive about my weight, so...
really? Yeah. No need to be. You're tall.
Thanks, mate.
Big boned.
So you went to see Will I Am.
I did.
What's he been doing?
He's been getting involved in consumer electronics. He's very, very passionate about it. He's been launching... I was at the launch of his I Am Plus Photo Socio camera line, which is this new range of basically clip-on lens cameras with cases for the iPhone to sort of turn it more into like a point-and-shoot camera. And they're really fashionable. Like, he's been involved in Beats headphones. So this is him going out on his own and doing a similar kind of thing with clip-on cameras. Because, I mean, there are just as good for half the price ones out there.
But what do you mean clip-on cameras? You mean like additional lenses that you put on in front of the iPhone?
Yeah, like imagine a iPhone case that looks like an old vintage camera.
Oh, God.
With lenses that you can take out and put in.
Okay.
They actually look really, really good. That's the annoying thing about them.
Do you know what, though? The thing is, though, the annoying thing about this, sorry to interrupt you, is that this isn't the most interesting thing.
Oh, no.
The camera thing is a tangent, to the bigger bit of news, which is that he wants to go to school to learn to code.
He does.
Give up the next 20 years of his life to work in consumer tech.
He spent most of the launch talking about how much he loves technology, and he says he's going to dedicate his life to it. He was saying stuff like he's spoken in the past about the STEM subjects, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And he was saying that he wants to inspire kids to get involved. The direct quote from him was, "It's important for me to inspire these kids, especially females. If you think of all the leading tech innovators, there's no female there, but that has to change. And who's going to inspire and encourage these kids to be the next Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates and Steve Jobs? It should be my sister next, or your sister or niece. Or nephew, if you have friends in Brixton or East London, it should come from there."
Liv, what do you think of him saying that there are no female innovators that need to, that can be aspired to be?
Well, I think there is a lack of female role models within tech. That's, I mean, it's a sad fact, but it is a fact. And it would be great to see more women at the very top end of the industry who mm-hmm. younger girls could look up to.
What about someone like Marissa Mayer? She's in charge of Yahoo, ex-Google.
Of course, but I think you still would put Zuckerberg, Gates and Jobs at a level higher than her.
I agree. It's ironic, really, that the first programmer was a woman.
Yeah, really. Well, exactly. Mm.
Okay, so I've interrupted you. So he said he's going to dedicate the next 20 years of his life to the field of consumer electronics.
Yes, he said he's done basically 20 years of touring, playing music, and now he wants to spend the next 20 years. They're going to be exciting. They're going to be about connectivity and innovating new products. And it does sound like his life at the moment is pretty much him flying around the world. He'd just flown in from Brazil a couple of days before the launch, I think, just meeting people and sort of meeting coders and writers and people like that and getting ideas and stuff. This camera idea, he said he came up with it in January and it's coming out in for Christmas. Mm. And he said that actually, this X Factor for Tech show that he's mentioned before.
Yeah, we've talked about this, I think.
Yeah. That's definitely happening, he says. And he says that this camera project of his was kind of like a dry run. He says that the show is going to be the next iteration. He's now shown that he can do it himself, that he can have an idea and bring it within sort of 9-12 months to the market.
Well, if you're Will.i.am, you can bring a product to market with your massive existing marketing network. But I imagine it's not quite as easy.
But if he's helping those other people who are going to watch the show, then I guess, yeah. So he said that's definitely going to happen, although he did sort of, when someone asked him, is it going to be with Simon Cowell, he kind of said, oh, why do you have to say that? It's going to happen with someone. I don't know who it's going to happen with.
Really hook me up. I told you in the last time we talked about this, I think it should be one of us.
Oh, yeah.
That should be on there. It should be Will.i.am and Olivia or Ian or Nate.
Yeah.
Represent.
If you're listening, Will, we're here.
And I'm sure he is. Well, we'll give him and everyone else listening a quick break. But when we come back, we are going to talk about something that sounds dull, but it actually isn't. It's called the ITU and the control of the web.
Wired magazine, now available every month on Amazon Kindle Fire, selected Android tablets, as well as the full range of iPads, from Retina display down to the iPad mini. Don't miss out. Subscribe today at wired.co.uk/magazine.
Willkommen back. In a few moments, we are going to talk about the investigations into the inevitability of the robot uprising and the enslavement of all human race from our robotic overlords. But first, actually, it could be a slight bit of topical humour here. Some other overlords ruling humans, the European Parliament, perhaps.
Calm down, Farage.
All right. Come on, Liv. What's going on with the ITU?
Yeah, I think you should say other overlords, the ITU, because the European Parliament's kind of like...
I suppose the European is on our side, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. Some other robotic overlords, they go by the name of the ITU, and the European Parliament has been opposing them, Liv.
Yes.
Let's find out what the deets are here.
Now, this is a very kind of complex and convoluted issue at the moment, and it's kind of brewing now because there's a big event next week that's going to bring it all to light. But the ITU is the International Telecommunication Union, which is this kind of odd UN body that was initially set up to establish worldwide standards in telephony, actually the telegraph when it launched, and improve telecommunications infrastructure. Now, next week, on the 3rd of December, it's holding a major event in Dubai called the World Conference on International Telecommunications, where it'll bring together governments from all over the world to renegotiate some rules called the International Telecommunication Regulations, or the ITRs. I mean, it's so intergovernmental, bureaucratic nonsense.
And these were set up about 25 years ago, weren't they? Before we had most of the technologies we're using day to day.
Yeah, they were set up in 1988. And since then, obviously, a huge amount has changed when it comes to communications technologies. And so the ITU wants to update these regulations to make sure that they effectively cover the internet. This includes looking at areas of cybersecurity, financing new infrastructure and accessibility for people with disabilities. But The idea that the ITU is going to start trying to govern the internet is what's got people, including the European Parliament, Google, many companies, and Ed Vasey, who we spoke to last week as well, a little bit annoyed. They argue that the ITU should stick to covering telecommunications in the kind of purest sense and not encroach on the web and not kind of try to, you know, have any jurisdiction over the web. However, the ITU seems to think that it should have jurisdiction over the web and defines telecommunications as any transmission, emission or reception of signals, blah, 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 that are through any nature by wired, radio, optical or other electromagnetic systems. So very broad definition, which could technically cover the web.
Yeah, well, that could be the internet and or the web.
Yes, exactly. But there's a lot of confusion about the ITU. There's a lot of confusion about the event next week, Wicket, as it's horribly shortened to. But the broad concerns are thus. First of all, that it's been organised in secret. Only members have access to the proposals. So there's no one website where you can go. Well, there is now because someone's leaked them all, but you can't go and check out what the different countries are proposing. Secondly, the fact that the ITU is trying to extend its remit unjustifiably to the web. Thirdly, that it's not neutral. The ITU is meant to be a neutral body that's just facilitating the meeting of countries. And some argue that the kind of head of the ITU has actually got his own agenda. Fourthly, there's some very radical proposals from countries like Russia and Iran, like all these things about kind of controlling the web and trying to increase censorship. But the kind of key criticism people have is the fact that there has been no multi-stakeholder approach. Only governments are invited to vote. There are a few, you know, companies are allowed to come along, but none of the companies have any vote. No citizens get any vote in this. It's all decided by government members, which is not really how the internet developed at all. And obviously very different to how telecoms developed, where most telecommunication systems were government owned when they launched. However, I want to say here that despite all these concerns from the European Parliament, Ed Vasey, Google, I highly doubt that anything's going to happen from this. The way that this event runs means that there has to be a consensus on any new regulation. And although you have these ridiculous proposals from kind of countries which have a terrible track record for internet freedom, they're very unlikely to go through because they have to fight against the US and European countries who will be obviously very against some of these kind of more stringent proposals. So what's going to happen is there's going to be a lot of hot air and very little is actually going to change. The sorts of proposals that are going to come out are going to be so bland. Even when they do come out, they still have to be implemented in local law to have any kind of effect in those in local countries. And even if local countries don't do that, the ITU has no kind of effective mechanism to, what's it called? No enforcement mechanism. So if they don't do it, there's no repercussions. So I think we're making a lot of fuss over nothing.
The UN does pass stuff quite frequently that people just ignore as well.
Yes.
So it's, yeah.
Exactly. So it's an interesting issue that we're raising, this issue about we don't want internet freedoms to be restricted in any way, but I just don't think anything's going to happen.
It reminds me a lot of the argument over SOPA.
Yes.
You know, which was a similar proposition when, at least in the public eye, when that first came out, that there was this incredibly broad, you know, idea of how the web should be governed,
yes,
essentially. And I wonder how something like this would be, you know, would affect things like China. I mean, is China involved in this at all?
China's
involved,
and they've got some kind of fairly extreme ideas on what they would like as well.
So, I mean, how is it even possible to think that, you know, a country like the UK, or a nation like the UK, could be involved in discussions with China and have a mutually agreeable outcome on how the internet should be governed? Because those two governments, those two ways of thinking, they don't have democratic free ways of governing internet communications at all.
It strikes me
it's an impossible debate.
When I was researching this piece as well, there are kind of some interesting politics at the UN that seem to come to light. So apparently quite often countries, when they're negotiating these sorts of treaties, will submit quite extreme proposals that they don't seriously want to support, but then use them as a kind of negotiation tool to maybe get another proposal from one of their kind of not enemies, but perhaps more opposed countries to get one of their proposals off the table. So they'll say, oh, well, we'll agree to take off our radical idea about, you know, censoring the web if you agree to stop doing this. And so it's kind of, even though there are some radical proposals, it might be that they've just been kind of used as negotiation tools, which I thought was particularly interesting.
Well, you can read our full coverage of this. Liv's got some really great pieces on the website. If you search for ITU on wired.co.uk, you'll find a handy guide and a lot of other stories.
Yeah, and if you haven't heard about it this week, you are very unlikely to not hear about it next week. There's going to be a lot of chat about it online, so it's good to debrief now.
Let's talk about the inevitable robot uprising, Ian.
Because it's coming.
If it's inevitable, one must ask, what is going to happen and how can we stop it? And that, I believe, is a question that has been asked by philosophers and astrophysicists.
It is indeed. These are philosopher Hugh Price, astrophysicist Martin Rees, and Skype co-founder Jan Tillin. Am I pronouncing that right? Yes. Who have together set up at Cambridge University the Centre for the Study of Existential Risk, which is one of the most amazing names for a centre I've ever heard. It's been set up to investigate whether developments in human technology may pose new extinction-level risks to our species as a whole. And they've got experts from all kinds of disciplines here, and the idea is that we are developing technology that is, you know, kind of likely to lead to our own destruction.
This is made for some great headlines in the media over the last few days. But I have to say, I think this makes a lot of sense.
It does.
To a certain extent, at least. We are developing things that could perhaps have ramifications in the future that we're not currently predicting. And it's probably worth our while working out what might happen and then
before
it happens. I think the obvious thing to think here is something out of science fiction, where, you know, like 2001 Space Odyssey, when a computer takes over because it thinks it knows better.
Yeah.
I don't think it's really about that as such. I don't think this is about killer robots firing rockets into our houses.
No.
This is more about making sure that a robot knows to obey a human.
Yeah, exactly.
And basically just make sure that, you know, any kind of artificial intelligence is actually intelligent and recognizes its boss, I think, to a certain extent.
Well, Hugh Price told AFP, it seems a reasonable prediction that sometime in this or the next century, intelligence will escape from the constraints of biology. And that means when we're no longer the smartest thing around, we'll have to deal with machines that are not malicious, but machines whose interests don't include us. And that's totally what we expect. I mean, if you just think about, you know, nature doesn't really care one way or the other about us, but we still just have to negotiate around it. It's not attributing a moral value to it. It's just kind of what's going to happen. So we better be ready. It's not just, I mean, the headlines are about robots and AI and stuff, but that also includes biotechnology and nanotechnology and also climate change.
I feel as though it's going to come out with all these wonderful papers that explain exactly why and how the robots are going to overtake us and you know, enslave us, but not how to prevent it.
It does seem to be treating it basically as inevitable.
Yeah.
And I can't think of a reason why it would. I mean, if you look at the fact that things are getting more intelligent, we're making more intelligent things, there's got to be a point at which it overtakes us.
Well, there's an obvious solution. You know, I mean, humans are inevitably vicious and controlling and egomaniacal. I think that it's only right that if we're building humans in our image, essentially, that eventually they
robots
will...
Robots in our image.
No, but what makes a human? If they're more intelligent than us, are they not even more... don't they deserve the label human even more than we do if they're more intelligent than us?
No, because we're biological. They would be mechanical.
And human pinnacle of intelligence. It just means...
having a soul.
Ooh.
Oh, okay. We just suddenly went to a whole nother level.
It's the philosophy.co.uk podcast with philosopher Ian Steadman. Okay, well, let us know what you think. Are robots inevitably going to take over and try and control us? Or are they simply going to become smart enough to realize that, hey, those pesky humans, let's just ignore them. They're not worth our time. A bit like a tree may do, or a rat. we're going to wrap up there, but we did want to remind people that if you are free on the 5th of December at 1 p.m, come down to the Quadrant Arcade on Regent Street, because we are going to be there recording a live episode of the wired.co.uk podcast. You can win some stuff. Full details are on the website if you go to wired.co.uk/store. But basically, there are all the details you need. 1 p.m, Quadrant Arcade, the Wired pop-up store.
Be there or be square.
Be there or be, square, cube, any other rectangle.
Rhombus.
Any other rectangle?
Yeah.
Square is a rectangle.
Square is a rectangle.
Yeah.
Is it? Yeah. Yeah, it's just a rectangle with four.
I thought
four
rectangle had to have...
No, that's an oblong.
Nah, rectangle's two... just got four sides to it, hasn't it?
Oh,
that's
okay.
What it is.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah.
We've got a bit of feedback this week that we wanted to get to, and of course you can have your feedback read by our eyes and spoken by our mouths by emailing podcast@wired.co.uk. The first is from Anthony, who says, "Hiya, love the podcast. This is what I wish the government would do on smoking." This actually follows our conversation the other week about ways to combat smoking in the future. And he says, "From today, the minimum age for buying and smoking all forms of tobacco is 18. Next year, it could be 19, then 20, and so on. This would keep the current smokers happy and eventually prevent the kids from starting." Now, that's reasonably interesting as a thought, although it does mean that ultimately you'd have to be like 70 to buy cigarettes.
Yeah. And that's, I guess, the hope is that all the smokers would just die off, which is quite a cruel thing.
And how annoying if you were just under that cusp and you really wanted to smoke or were already smoking and you had to be constantly chasing the
kids seem to do all right.
Age of consent. Yeah.
Kids seem to find getting older people to buy them cigarettes. So it just ends up with like 16-year-olds asking 65-year-olds to go down the shop and buy them some cigarettes.
"Hey, Mavis, can you get us some fags?"
Yeah.
Words like that would be used. Kevin wrote in to compliment our discussion, actually, on the Pharma Book story. This is one that, Ian, you were talking about a few weeks ago. He says, "Do you think there is room for a LinkedIn or Facebook for charities? I seem to remember people saying that the social media space is saturated and has no new areas to go into, but could a charity link be the next new venture? I need to copyright this sooner. I might end up kicking myself in 10 years when somebody else sells the company for billions in 2021.
I hope they'd be giving those billions to charity.
Social network for charities.
There is something like that that exists already. And also the problem with that is who's going to fund it without any kind of delicious advertisers or paying.
You could imagine Facebook having a philanthropic arm perhaps in the future.
Yes.
And it could have charity, a pot of money for philanthropic apps on its service that could be used as networks in their own right.
Yeah,
because like that game online where you solve anagrams for rice, isn't there?
Yes,
something like that. Facebook game.
He also says, Kevin says, "Finally, I listen avidly to your podcast and always find something to grab my attention. Keep doing what you do in the way you do it." Thank you. We absolutely intend to, at least for the near future. And finally, Ezra wrote in to say, "Hi, I love animals, reading, dancing, and candies."
Thanks, Ezra.
So. Thanks for that. If you have other interesting insights, such as the first two, more than the last one, podcast@wired.co.uk is where you can send them. We do read everything. We don't get to read them all the time. Some of them are written by cretins who want to bring down our spirits.
Oh, wow.
No, they don't really. It's mostly people saying really interesting things.
They're and just spam. Quite,
yeah. But the shorter the better. Keep it short. Keep us...
enthralled.
Yeah. Liv, how else can people get in touch?
They can get in touch telepathically, or they can also get in touch via Twitter. We're at Wired UK, and we're also on facebook.com/WiredUK. And as always, you can also email us. But you've already told us the email address.
It's podcast@wired.co.uk.
Yeah,
it's worth drilling into your head. Send us an email now. What do you think some of the topics we discussed this week? Robot uprising, for example. But on that note, we will see you, hopefully, literally see you in 1 week's time, 1 p.m, Wednesday the 5th of December at the Quadrant Arcade on Regent Street. Until then, goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
What do you think a bee is like to eat? I imagine they're quite soft.